Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Around the world, all of them false alarms. India is lodging a strong protest with the Netherlands today over the way it handled 12 Indian passengers who were on a flight to Bombay that was sent back to Amsterdam. The passengers were held for a day and then released after authorities said there was no evidence of a terrorist threat. An Aer Lingus flight from New York was evacuated in Ireland today because authorities said they received a threat that liquid explosives were on board, but nothing was found. Doug Cameron covers aviation for the Financial Times. He's on the line from Chicago. And Doug, what do these diversions mean for the airlines?
Despite the disruption and the small amount of false alarms, fortunately turned out to be, people are still traveling in pretty much the same numbers as they were before August the 10th.
But what about paying for the increased security that's been put in place after this alleged plot?
This is certainly a key issue both for the airlines, government authorities and airports indeed. There's going to be an evolving debate over the next few months about what different measures might be taken to deal with this enhanced terror threat, these liquid explosives in particular. Now, how that is going to be paid for, you're going to see more security measures, and you're also going to see a debate and, to be honest, a battle between the airlines, airports and government authorities about who actually pays for these extra measures.
And at this point, it's unclear exactly what types of security measures will be implemented where. There will be different security measures at different places around the world, correct?
This is certainly a key part of the debate and something which contributed to the confusion in the days immediately after August 10, when listeners may recall there were different policies about what you could carry on bags depending on where you were traveling and where you were leaving. I think you're going to see already within the European Union countries moves to create some sort of harmonized policies both for how you're checked at the airport and also what you can carry. I think you're going to see that start to happen on a transatlantic and into a global basis mm-hmm. as well.
So was the industry on pretty solid footing before this whole terror plot came about?
It's certainly it's a game of two halves. The U.S. industry has performed in a very different way from the most of the rest of the world. The U.S. industry has lost close to $40 billion since 9/11. Passenger traffic has recovered, but profitability has only really started to come in during the summer because of higher fares and basically fewer aircraft flying around. If you look at the rest of the world, passenger traffic has continued to grow very strongly, something like 6% a year. And most of the other large carriers in the world, the British Airways or Air France, have been making near record profits despite the fact that fuel prices have pretty much doubled over the past 2 years.
Right. So fuel prices, how I was going to ask you that, fuel prices, how does that play into all of this? Does that seem to be affecting, having any sort of marked effect on what's happening?
Well, the two key pressures for the airlines are what happens to passenger travel, and that's a function of the health of the economy and also any concerns over security. The other factor is oil prices, which, as I said, have doubled over the past 2 years. Airlines have had to adapt to that basically by cutting costs wherever they can outside of the fuel arena. They've done that very successfully, and that's allowed them to continue to make money. As far as the fuel prices are concerned, airlines have also managed to pass on some of the increases to passengers in the form of surcharges, which listeners may find on their travel tickets when they purchase fares, purchase tickets rather.
Now, the U.S. airline industry was losing a lot of money and has been losing money since 9/11. There was a bailout for the airline industry. Would you make any prediction that that may be what we'll see again because of all of this?
I think the government's action is not going to be in the form of a bailout, but actually to allow consolidation between U.S. airlines, which would improve the competitive position of the airlines that remain.
I think when we look at all of this, when we look at the alerts and the debates about the cost and what's been happening, we almost wonder, what did we learn from 9/11? Are there lessons from 9/11 that are being implemented in the airline industry right now?
There certainly are. The very practical measures were things like the steel doors on cockpit doors so that 9/11 couldn't be repeated. What has happened is that those threats that were perceived after 9/11 have been dealt with. The problem the industry now faces is that potential terrorists obviously move on and try to exploit any other weaknesses. The challenge for the industry is to identify those weaknesses and close them down.
Doug Cameron, correspondent for the Financial Times. He spoke with us from his office in Chicago. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
School bells will soon start ringing again, and with them will be what many kids and an increasing number of parents often dread, nightly homework. There have been studies indicating that students are getting more homework than they used to. In some school districts, limits have been imposed on homework following complaints from parents. And Boston-based education writer Alfie Cohn is questioning why there's homework at all. Alfie Cohn joins us to talk about his new book, The Homework Myth, Why Our Kids Get Too Much of a Bad Thing. Welcome.
Thank you.
I guess the title sums it up then, too much of a bad thing, yes?
That's right, exactly.
And why is that?
Well, we already know, if we're parents or kids, that homework is often the cause of considerable stress and exhaustion and family conflict, not enough time to do what one needs to do after school, but we assume that it's all worth it. At least we parents do. We assume that at least kids are getting something out of it, that it's boosting their achievement or reinforcing the skills they've learned in school or helping them to develop self-discipline or good work habits. But all of these assumptions that we simply take on faith turn out not to be true.
Well, let's start with a couple of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, haven't studies shown that there is some sort of link between the amount of homework that's been done and academic achievement?
At best, only at the high school level. There is absolutely not a single study that has ever demonstrated even a correlation between academic achievement by any measure and how much homework elementary school students do, or indeed whether they do any. At the high school level, there is a weak correlation that often vanishes when you apply more sophisticated statistical techniques, and even then, it doesn't prove that the homework caused the higher achievement. So when you look more closely at the data, you find that it's basically built on sand, this notion that for kids to learn well, they have to work what amounts to a second shift after they get home from 6 or 7 hours in school.
But what about the study skills and study habits? I mean, that argument that it teaches kids good study skills.
If I throw you in the swimming pool, it doesn't teach you to swim. If I make you do a project, especially one you're not so keen on doing, and give you a week to do it, that doesn't teach you how to budget your time or do the research at all. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, no research has ever shown any of the non-academic advantages like better study skills, independence, self-discipline. These might well be called urban myths, except that they're taken for granted in suburbs and rural areas, too.
There's something in your book that mm-hmm. you feature, and it's actually an excerpt from Parent Magazine.
Right.
It's on page 5 of your, uh-huh. of your book. Would you mind reading that?
Oh, no, I'd be happy to. If children, said the author in Parents Magazine, are not required to learn useless and meaningless things, homework is entirely unnecessary for the learning of common school subjects. But when a school requires the amassing of many facts which have little or no significance to the child, learning is so slow and painful that the school is obliged to turn to the home for help out of the mess the school has created.
And that was written in
November of 1937.
1937.
Good luck finding anything that is thoughtful and critical of homework in any mainstream magazine, Parents or otherwise, in the last 50 years. Now, when you go to Parents Magazine or its ilk, what you'll find is tips for helping your kids focus and finish and mindlessly do whatever they've been told.
So when did we start doing homework? When did kids start doing homework?
Oh, it goes back more than 100 years. I didn't look back beyond that. I was interested to find some research questioning its validity, and I think it was 1897. I don't know if there's research before that, but homework predates that. And originally, it was based on a model of learning that was about rote memorization. And so the more times you repeat mindless facts and dates and definitions, or translations from Latin, as the case may be, the more likely you are to be able to recite perfectly the next morning. Fortunately, research on learning has come a long way since then about the need for kids to actively construct meaning rather than being seen as empty receptacles into which facts are poured. Unfortunately, the practice of homework hasn't kept up with that research, and we continue throwing around behaviorist terms like reinforce, which is based on a mindless skill and drill approach. So if the data kept up with what we understand about learning, I think we would be looking at this practice of assigning homework in a very different way. I mean, we assume this mechanistic view that kids are like vending machines. You put in more homework, you get out more learning. And it just don't work that way.
But isn't there an argument to be made for some rote learning? And I thought that there was a school of thought that maybe was recognizing memorization as a valuable tool, particularly if you look at the concrete example of multiplication facts. I mean, kids need to know these. And there has been a ton of criticism about some math programs that focus on abstract, and kids are not even able to get to division because they haven't really learned how to multiply.
Well, most of that criticism comes from folks who are, in many cases, conservative ideologues who, for ideological reasons, prefer a very different approach to education in general that's not really about kids being active thinkers. And some of it comes from parents who are just uncomfortable because their kids aren't learning math the way they did. Notice that this is the same example, almost the sole example, that people are able to give in favor of the drill and skill approach is the multiplication table. Even if it was true that kids needed to learn that, and even if they had to do it at home, which is not at all clear to me, that leaves 99% of learning that oughtn't to be like that at all, the drill and skill approach. But in fact, even with respect to multiplication, we tend to learn the stuff that we use. And the best kind of math programs are those where kids are working on problems that matter, problems that grow out of their own experience, out of the headlines, out of the questions they have, that require them to integrate multiplication or other skills, rather than sitting down and saying 9 times 7 is 63. But again, assume I'm wrong about all that and you need to multiply. That really doesn't justify the vast majority of homework that kids are assigned.
But the theory of practice makes perfect. I mean, we see that everywhere. We see it in music. You don't become a good musician if you don't practice, right? I mean, isn't there something to that theory of how human beings perform and what practice might do in terms
of
enhancing
that? Well, the interesting question that raises is the extent to which understanding mathematical concepts or becoming truly literate is like learning the violin or tennis, for example. It's an example of what philosophers would call question begging, that is to say, assuming precisely what needs to be proved to say that most of what we do in academics is just like music. There is an element by which we want to practice, but practicing doesn't create understanding. All practicing does is create automatic behaviors. Most learning isn't or shouldn't be just about behavior. It should be about helping kids understand ideas from the inside out.
We're talking with education researcher Alfie Cohn about his new book, The Homework Myth, Why Our Kids Get Too Much of a Bad Thing. When we come back, how about the pressure to keep American school children competitive? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. And Alfie, before the break, you were saying there are not many educational benefits to homework, but what about high school kids who are in competitive situations and have to squeeze their learning into 40 and 50-minute class periods? Shouldn't they do some work at home?
In the book, I try to come up with half a dozen reasons to explain why we persist in giving homework and even call for more of it, despite the absence of evidence showing that it's beneficial. One of the reasons has to do with our misunderstanding of learning. Another reason, I think, has to do with our distrust of kids. We want to keep the young ones moral after school, and homework is literally busy work in the minds of some adults. But then there's this notion of competitiveness, where here the goal is not to help individual kids learn and love learning. It's to try to make sure that our kids beat the kids in Japan, which I find to be an egregious and problematic notion. But I'm sorry, your larger question is, aren't they busy?
Well, let's go point by point for a minute here.
Okay.
Because they have so much to do, maybe 40 minutes in a class, do they need a little reinforcement because they may not have enough time to really make sure that they've mastered something before they go on to the next thing? That would be first.
Right. Well, again, the verb reinforcement comes from the work of B.F. Skinner and others who worked on lab animals to talk about making sure that behaviors become automatic and are reinforced. That's where, and the more you question that model of learning, the less likely you would be to think in those terms. If your question is, do kids have enough time to learn everything they're being asked to learn in school? The answer is probably not, nor would they have enough time if they spent 5 hours after school doing homework. But the real question is, how valuable is that curriculum? Why are there 40 or 50-minute periods before, you know, they're doing Faulkner, the bell rings, they salivate and move on to binomial equations?
Exactly.
The model is wrong. Homework, that is to say, making kids shoulder the burden of an excessive and misguided approach to instruction, is not the solution. We have to rethink what we ask kids to do, the extent to which the students can play an active role in helping to shape their curriculum and answer questions of their own that are meaningful to them. And then when you create that, you find, and I found certainly in my research, a bunch of schools where they said, we don't need homework. I found some high-pressured traditional high schools where a chemistry teacher or a social studies teacher said, I never give homework. And even by the stupid conventional measures of standardized test scores, my kids are doing just fine.
If they didn't have homework, mm-hmm. would they do something constructive? And is there mm-hmm. any evidence to say that they really would want to and wouldn't want to just, I don't know, surf the internet or something if they weren't doing homework?
Well, I think we have to ask what we mean by constructive. Surfing the internet, in some cases, offers skills and values even if they don't represent the traditional academic skills, which they've just had all day. Second, a number of schools whose teachers and principals I've talked to have found that the act of reducing or even eliminating homework has, in fact, freed up the students to do stuff that continues logically from what they've been doing in school, so that they come in talking about current events, for example, or a poem they've had the chance to write, a book that they've read. Let's assume the kids come home and don't read a single book all week, that at 3 o'clock or whatever, they want to hang out with their friends and make new friends. They want to get some exercise. They want to get some rest. They want to just chill after all day. Why not? Why should they have to be productive in the factory sense of that word day after day, even if they don't do something that meets our high standards of constructiveness every afternoon?
So what would you say then? No homework? Is homework never a good thing?
I don't go that far. In the homework myth, my very simple suggestion is that we change the default. Right now, the default setting is homework every day or several times a week. In other words, the teachers didn't begin by saying, when it's really necessary and appropriate, we're going to ask kids to do an assignment after school. What they start out by saying is, kids are going to have math homework every Tuesday and Thursday, or they're going to have homework of some kind up to X minutes or hours every night. Later on, we'll figure out what to make them do. And that is a ludicrous notion when you think about it for 2 seconds. The assumption that homework per se, irrespective of its content, is beneficial has never, ever been justified by any research or experience. So what I prescribe is simply changing the default to no homework unless and until the teacher is able to justify a given assignment as being so valuable that it's worth interrupting kids' free time when school is over. And I think there are some assignments that meet that test. Most don't. If teachers were to take that advice and say you have to opt in to homework rather than opting out, the immediate effects would be a lot less homework, and the homework that existed would be a lot better.
But at the same time, there are two things. You mentioned Japan, and then you talk about this getting out at 3 o'clock, and maybe they just want to hang out with their friends. But, you know, a colleague here who lived in China was mm-hmm. Astounded when she found out that kids go to school 7 o'clock in the morning. They do have a long lunch break, time for a nap, but they stay in school until 6 o'clock. They go home and eat, and then they study some more.
This may be more true, for example, in Shanghai than out in the provinces. It may be more true in high school than it is in elementary school. But the point is that my understanding is in both Japan and China that people are starting to reconsider this. They're starting to see the social and emotional and intellectual costs of this enormous burden. If we decide that it's not beneficial, even intellectually, and that's a point that's rarely made here, by working kids hard, we are often undermining their love of knowledge. They may memorize more facts, but understand them in a more shallow fashion. To say nothing of the psychological, artistic, social, emotional costs of this kind of life. And a number of people in Asia are starting to say, this is nuts what we're doing to our kids.
You have kids?
I do.
Do they do their homework?
Well, it becomes interesting when my kids know that I've just written a book calling into question the value of homework and are wondering about theirs. And it's something I want to bring to the attention of their teachers when necessary. You know, so many parents, even thoughtful, educated parents, have never really thought about whether the homework is necessary or valuable. They haven't even looked that carefully at what it is. They just think, do your homework. In fact, sadly, that's sometimes the first question we ask of our kids when they come home. Do you have any homework? What a sad way to greet our children after the full day, you know? Homework is just one example of so many other practices in education and across our culture where we don't ask the questions that matter. We simply go along and accept on faith the things that we've been told.
Alfie Cohn's new book is The Homework Myth, Why Our Kids Get Too Much of a Bad Thing. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science, Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy.
This Neil Young song may be the most high-profile sign of any movement to impeach President George W. Bush. Bloggers are weighing in, of course, and there are impeachment resolutions pending in at least three state legislatures. Congressman John Conyers, ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, where impeachment proceedings would have to start, is the most vocal lawmaker on the issue, but even he knows there's not much of a chance of it going forward unless his party captures Congress in the midterm elections. Journalist Dave Lindorf is among those banging the drum for impeachment. He's co-author of the book, The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. And Dave, let me ask you, impeachment may be a hot topic on the internet, but it has to start in Congress, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi says it's off the table no matter what happens in November.
Yeah, I don't put any stock in that at all. I mean, I think the leadership in the Democrats has the mistaken notion that the public would look at this the way they looked at the Republican attempt to impeach Clinton, and it's not the same thing at all. First of all, several professional polling organizations, Zogby and Ipsos, have found that a majority of the American public would favor an impeachment on the issues of NSA spying and lying about the war, and as many as 80% of Democrats. So I think what it is that the leadership of the Democrats are so used to being afraid of Republican attacks that they just don't know how to deal with this. But it's an interesting impeachment issue because it's more popular among the grassroots than it is among the so-called opposition in Congress. Mm.
Can you outline your case just briefly for us here, why you think this should happen?
We say that President Bush is actually sort of the Willie Sutton of congressional violators. He's committed so many constitutional crimes that the list just goes on and on. Things like the signing statements where he actually ignores acts or parts of acts passed by Congress just go to the heart of the whole issue of abuse of power and violating the whole Founding Fathers concept of tripartite government. It's interesting that in the last 2 months, two courts, the Supreme Court and a federal court in Detroit, have actually declared that the president has violated the Constitution and laws of the U.S., in two counts, one being his arbitrary declaration that the U.S. doesn't have to, or he doesn't have to follow the Geneva Conventions, which are part of U.S. criminal code, the other being the NSA spying without any warrants being approved by the FISA court. In both these cases, he's actually been declared to have been in violation of law and of the Constitution.
Now, the White House has some arguments for all of these things, and we could go point by point, but let's just say the big one for a lot of these things is we're engaged in a war. It's a war against terrorism, and there are times that the chief executive has to do certain things or be exempted from certain rules in order to protect the country.
First of all, I take issue with the whole concept that the war on terrorism is a war. It's not a war, and there are plenty of people who have made that point clearly. That aside, The Supreme Court has already ruled that his argument that this so-called war gives him extra constitutional powers as a commander-in-chief is simply bogus. They said that it is not true and that the president, in his role as commander-in-chief, must adhere to all the requirements of the Constitution. So his basic claim, and this has been one that he's used to argue that he could do the FISA warrantless spying, that he could withdraw habeas corpus from American citizens, that he could do these signing statements and reject laws passed by Congress, all of those are premised on his claim that he's commander-in-chief in time of war and he doesn't need to obey the Constitution. And the Supreme Court slapped that premise down.
The Constitution says impeachable offenses are considered high crimes and misdemeanors. How are those defined and how are what you're talking about here fit under that definition?
This is very important because the Clinton impeachment farce really confused a lot of Americans and even a lot of people in Congress as to what impeachment is about. It made it into this issue of did the president violate the law by committing perjury under oath? And in fact, the high crimes and misdemeanors that the founding fathers talked about referred to political crimes. That's why, for instance, in the Nixon impeachment, the article referred to Nixon lying to the American people. That's not a crime. You don't go to jail for it. You don't pay a fine for it. But it was viewed very seriously as a crime. And conversely, in that Nixon impeachment, it was clearly found, it was undeniable, that Nixon lied and cheated on his income tax, which is a felony. You and I would go to jail for it. But they tossed that out as a article of impeachment because it was felt it didn't rise to the level of high crime and misdemeanor.
But in this particular case, you feel that these certainly do.
Well, we have 10 categories of crimes, any one of which would be sufficient to require his removal from office. Things like the signing statements, which, if this power is not challenged, becomes the baseline for any future president, whoever that may be, to simply ignore acts of Congress.
I also read that in certain cases, in Ohio, for instance, some of the Republicans there are bringing this up as an issue in the November election, saying that if the Democrats do take a critical seat, there's this threat of impeachment hanging over our head, and we could have this whole messy procedure that will drag everybody down if the Democrats take control. Could it backfire?
I would expect them to do that. But I think it's an act of desperation, because if the Congress does get taken over by the Democrats, there will be bills of impeachment. And all it takes is one member of Congress to submit one of those bills, and John Conyers then takes charge of it. And I know from the fact that he's put out a 350-page tome outlining all the president's crimes that he's going to look very favorably on and will hold, I'm sure, whatever Nancy Pelosi may say, will hold hearings on impeachment. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, during the Nixon impeachment, when those hearings were starting, only a small minority of Americans thought impeachment was a good idea. But as you started having people who were under subpoena and under threat of jail if they lied under oath, telling the truth, people like John Dean or L. Patrick Gray, you know, eventually the story of Nixon's criminality started to come out unfiltered on the congressional hearings on TV, as they would again. And it turned the tide, both among the public and among even Nixon's supporters in Congress. These are really serious crimes that this administration has committed, and they go, as I said, to the heart of our Constitution and the survival of the democracy that we've lived with.
Journalist Dave Lindorf is co-author, along with Barbara Olshansky, of the book The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Well, we said it was a provocative topic, and we got a lot of response following our conversation with Yossi Sheffi, chairman of the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics, on what lessons might be learned from Hezbollah's work in rebuilding Lebanon following the violence there, and could those lessons possibly be applied to Hurricane Katrina reconstruction. Leanne Clausen of Mason City, Iowa, sent us this email. I was a human rights worker for 4 years in the Middle East, including time in Iraq, Israel, and Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Afghanistan. I did notice that with Hezbollah in South Lebanon last year, their social work was jaw-dropping. They built roads, parks, restaurants, hotels, school buildings, playgrounds, and amusement parks. They provided tangible development improvements to the area after the Israeli occupation. That, in turn, built their support base among the people. Also during that interview, Yossi Sheffi said that though Hezbollah has promised that within 72 hours it would find homes for those in Lebanon displaced by the war, Sheffi wants to give it a year to see if that actually happens. Well, that brought this call from Sharif Mobley in Philadelphia.
I think we're a little too quick to pass judgment on them and say that they're not going to come through with their promise and make all of the reasons why they won't come through just because our politicians sometimes make promises that don't go through. We don't call them liars before the promise is not fulfilled. We wait and then we get disappointed and then we forget about what happened.
Kamal Hakim of Phoenix, Arizona, wrote in following our conversation this week with physicist and musician Peter Pesek, who's author of Sky in a Bottle. And we talked about the age-old question, why is the sky blue? Well, during our conversation, Peter talked about some of the negative associations with that color through the ages. And he said in the Quran, the devils have blue eyes. Kamal wrote, I have read the Quran completely and have listened to many audio recitations of the Quran, and I can say the Quran does not say anything like that. Well, to help us set the record straight, we turn to Dr. Mahmoud Ayoub. He's a professor of Islamic studies and comparative religion at Temple University, and he's author of the book, The Quran and Its Interpreters. Dr. Ayoub, does the Quran mention the color blue?
The Quran mentions the color blue in Surah 20, verse 102. But the reference there need not be to the eyes, but to the color blue as a result of fear and confusion of the people who committed heinous sins in this life.
So the people who committed bad crimes were colored blue, but it wasn't necessarily eye color.
Yes, although there is at least one instance in pre-Islamic Arabia of a woman with blue eyes who had certain powers that made her able to see things at very, very far away, and therefore she could always alert her own people to any possible danger. So when her area was in the end conquered, the first thing they did is they blinded this woman so that she could not use her eyes. So there is a reference to the color blue as being the source of power or ill omen. To this day in Mediterranean cultures, there is an idea that blue eyes can cast the evil eye on particularly a child or a very pretty girl or a handsome young man and so on.
All right. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And finally, after our visit with The Main Squeeze, an accordion ensemble in Peaks Island, Maine, Phil Mosley of Stratford, New Hampshire, wanted to know what music we played at the conclusion of the segment. Well, it was Music for a Found Harmonium by the Penguin Cafe Orchestra. And if you missed it, here's an encore. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and your town. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. This song, Dandelion, is by a musician whose name is not easy to pronounce but is one to remember. Anja Duvakot is gaining attention in the folk music world. This summer, she won the prestigious New Folk Award at the Kerrville Folk Festival, and the Newport Folk Festival was already booked when the producers heard Duvakot and fit her into the show. She's just released her first major studio CD called Big Dream Boulevard, and Anja Duvakot joins us in studio to talk about her sudden notoriety and to play for us as well. Anja, this song, Dandelion, has been described as a resilient anthem to wallflowers everywhere. Is it about you?
Oh, yes. It's definitely about me. Most of my songs are very personal. I just tell my story and hope that someone else can relate. But this particular song is about sort of the wallflower that doesn't really get the guy that she's into, but sort of has also a wild, beautiful side to her, and so it sort of celebrates being a dandelion.
Yeah, I think it's the guy's fault for not recognizing the beauty of the dandelion.
It's like that, yeah. And yet there's also an amount of, remorse and regret about not being recognized as beautiful.
Some lonely times, your childhood. You moved here from Germany.
Right, yeah.
When you were a teenager.
Yeah, I moved here when I was 14 and I didn't know English very well. So I was definitely an outcast in high school in that I just didn't understand the language. I didn't know how to, fit in and be cool. And I had kind of a difficult home life. So music just was a savior, really, during those years.
It was difficult for you because of your parents, your mother, is that right?
Yeah, and I had a very strict stepfather and he kind of tried to, I guess, disempower me and take things away from me. So music was one thing that he really wasn't able to take.
Yeah, I read a quote from you where you said that listening to the music really saved your life. Would you quote it that strongly? Would you still describe it that way?
Yes, I would, actually. My parents were so strict that I actually wasn't allowed to leave the house. This sounds kind of extreme, but it's true. And so I didn't have friends because I wasn't able to hang out with other people socially. So really, these voices in my headphones when I walked through the neighborhood with my, John Gork and Ellis Paul, they were kind of my closest friends in that they were singing about themselves. And I felt like I knew them through their songs, and they kind of gave me courage and strength. So,
do you still hear from your family now?
No, I'm not in touch with them anymore.
Because of your music?
No, I mean, many reasons. But they were also very opposed to my trying to do music. They always felt it was a frivolous pursuit.
Do you think that sense of loss comes through in a lot of your songwriting?
Yeah, I can't really lie. And I believe that to be a writer, you really don't want to lie, because I think the most powerful sentiments come from truth. And I think that's what songs do. They kind of like make neat little packages out of things that are confusing. You can kind of craft something beautiful out of a whole big pile of just conflicting thoughts and make it kind of beautiful.
So almost redemptive in a way.
Yeah. All the songs have something of myself in them, be it autobiographical or something I feel. I mean, or my values are represented in the songs. Like, I think I have a lot of songs that sort of take the side of the underdog, and I'm just really interested in what makes people the way they are, because I've struggled with my own past and overcoming certain things and kind of seeing the gray areas in life has always been an inspiration and driving force in my writing.
We're going to listen to a song, Sex Band-Aid, and it may bring to mind what we've heard from folks at the Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island and some others who've described your singing as taking something deeply personal and making it universal. Do you think that this song does that?
For me, it's only deeply personal, but I'm glad that it ends up being universal. I mean, I think everything that we as humans feel personally is on some level universal, because we're all kind of the same in a way. I guess I just think it's boring to just tell a specific story without kind of a lesson. Lesson is a little too didactic, but sort of an over... I guess I write stories, but I also have an agenda as to a thought. You know, it's something bigger than just the story itself. I am weak and I need you, so exile me if you want to. Open the floodgates, throw a sex band-aid on my open.
your writing, some have credited your lyrics to almost a sense of distance from the language because you didn't speak English that well when you first came here as a teenager. Do you think that that's influenced your songwriting?
I think I started writing in such a vacuum, and I still didn't speak English that well, that when I first began to write, I was not really influenced by a lot of cliches or use of language of other people. I was just making it up from, you know, from the heart. So I guess my beginnings were not as schooled.
No accent. You have no accent.
No, not anymore.
No. Did you have to work on that?
No, it just faded away over the years. Mm.
You're going to finish with a song called Judas. Can you explain why you wrote this song?
The character of Judas just really fascinated me, and I was thinking about what makes a person be a traitor and what makes a person do bad things, and the Columbine thing. I guess I'm kind of bothered about how in America we never really seem to explore the motives of people that commit crimes. We just write it off as crazy, hateful, but we never really delve into like the psychology of what might be wrong with our society or what might have precipitated things like terrorism. And I just feel that you can go deeper with good and bad.
Can you play Judas for us?
It's called Judas.
Judas Iscariot is kicking up seashells and he is cursing. He's being tortured by the roaring in his mind that won't surrender the sea. And even here alone in the dark, a thousand eyes are burning into his heart, holes into his heart. And Jesus, he was the schoolyard martyr, was every mother's perfect son. Not like Judas in the back of the school bus, invisible to
Anja Duvikot's new CD is Big Dream Boulevard. For more on Anja and her music, visit our website, here-now.org.
Joseph was the head coach at the high school. They were living down on Judas's street. They'd be pitching.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Judas's father.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Former FEMA director James Lee Witt on the lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina. Also, losing